What's the most painful rejection you've ever had?
Oh, we are getting straight into it. I love it. The most painful rejection I've ever had. Funny enough, this comes to mind. Probably seventh grade basketball team. I got cut from this traveling team called COBO, Central Oregon Basketball Organization. And that was the first time I'd ever been cut from a team. First time I'd ever kind of been on the brink, and I was really hoping to make it. And getting cut felt like a big rejection, and it also ended my basketball career quite early.
Wow. Yeah. And how did you feel after that, if you can remember?
We're going way back. I felt disappointed. I felt left out. I think that's the thing about rejection, and obviously we're going to talk a lot about rejection today. It depends on the type of rejection, but when you specifically are rejected and a bunch of your friends are not, and they make the team, and now you are on the outside, it definitely feels isolating. It feels lonely. So I'd go with those two words probably as the feeling.
It's because we have this in-group, out-group bias, right? So if we're singled out from the crowd, that just triggers our monkey brain, our caveman brain, who would have died if that happened in, you know, the caveman era, 10,000, 100,000 years ago, and it stuck with us, isn't it?
And add the fact that it was back in middle school, which middle school is kind of a horrific period for anyone who goes through it. It was definitely tough. But I appreciate you asking the question. I literally haven't thought about that in 20 years.
Really? Yeah. Well, it's, I think, what period is middle school for, I'm British, and for the British listeners, what age is that roughly?
That would have been, I think it would have been 12. So I'm not that old. I'm not 32. I'm 30, but I haven't thought about that in years.
Yeah. And middle school and secondary school, why do you think it is such a harsh period for people growing up? Because I remember my social anxiety was like, that was when it was peak level anxiety, was that era. What was it like for you?
Yeah. So for me, middle school in America starts sixth grade. And I believe the average age is about 11. So 11 to 13, you're in what's called middle school. And then around 13, 14, you go to high school for the next 4 years. And I think it's particularly tough in middle school because, at least for me, that was when I was going through puberty. So you go from, for me, I was a late bloomer. I remember halfway through fifth grade, halfway through the school year, I started to like girls. Like the first half, girls were the enemy. I wanted nothing to do with them. And then the second half of the year, I was like, oh, wait, okay, there might be something here. And then you go through middle school and you're just, your body's changing, your mind's changing. And everyone, I'll just speak for myself, I was trying to fit in and be cool and follow what the cool kids were doing.
Yeah.
So it's a period of you are changing. And at the same time, I think you're really trying to model what everyone else is doing. So there's this hypervigilance on, am I cool? Am I doing the right things? This fear of not, this fear of doing the wrong thing. And then in high school too, I think it can be bad.
Yeah.
We can get into this. I wore a mask for much of my life trying to fit in, but I think middle school, especially because you're kind of in this big transitionary period and you're starting to be in a group with, you know, you're 11 in sixth grade and there's like 13-year-olds. So you're kind of in with different age groups.
Yeah. That hypervigilance is such a good description of it. It perfectly summarizes it in the sense that we're so acutely aware of our status and where we fit in the hierarchy, even if it's slightly unconscious. We're not thinking, oh, I want to be high status. It's just, no, I need to fit in with the popular kids. And tell me about the mask you were wearing, because personally, that was my era where I was trying to fit in with the cool kids a lot as well during that period.
Well, I definitely want to hear about your own era of that as well, but I'll go first.
Sure. Yeah,
so for me, I didn't even realize it until after I graduated from college. And here in America, you graduate from university around, like, I think I was 22. And I realized that I had been wearing a mask all of high school, all of college. And I was being who I thought other people wanted me to be instead of being my true self. So I was very focused on fitting in. I was a social chameleon, and there was positives to it. I could fit in with any group. I could assimilate. Yeah. I could quickly make friends and kind of feel out the vibe and then be part of the group quickly. But the cost of that was feeling like I was never actually showing up as myself.
Yeah.
And that people liked or disliked the projected version of myself, not actually me. And we were just talking about Chris Williamson a little bit before this. Shout out Modern Wisdom. he talks a lot about this, where if you are wearing a mask and you are successful, none of the admiration and the acknowledgments land, because people are admiring the person you were pretending to be instead of your actual self. And you're the only one who knows that. So there's a there's a cost to that that's really uncomfortable.
And what part of you were you hiding that you didn't want people to see or you thought were going to judge you?
My quirkiness, my soul, I've realized, is very playful. And that's why I think playfulness is so important. I'm always trying to take myself less seriously. One of my favorite quotes is by Albert Hubbard. And he says, "Don't take life too seriously. You'll never make it out alive." And I'm constantly trying to remind myself of that, because I was trying to be cool. I was trying to be serious. I was trying to be tough, all the things. Like in college, people would call me soft and I'd be like, "I'm not soft. Watch me drink 10 beers." And now someone calls me soft and I'm like, "Yeah, you're right. Like, I'm going to bed at 9 p.m. tonight and I'm going to love it."
Yeah.
And so, hiding the quirky, fun, playful, weird side of myself. And like I said, it wasn't until I graduated from university when I realized, oh crap, I've been wearing this mask. And when I really noticed it was that everything in my external world was lined up to the mask I was wearing. So I don't know if you believe in manifestation or the law of attraction.
I
put those things in the category of literally false, metaphorically true. So I don't actually think that us meditating on something necessarily pulls it closer to us. But when you're meditating on it and you're thinking about it, you start to take the actions that do make it happen. So that's why it's maybe literally false, but metaphorically true. Because if you act as if it's true, it's fun, it actually works. And I think it's a helpful belief to go through life with. But I started to notice that everything I seemed to be manifesting in my life was not what I wanted. And I got really frustrated. And then I realized, oh, wait, I was actually manifesting everything, but it was in alignment with the mask I was wearing. So I was working in finance. I was working in private equity. I thought that was my dream. But I soon started to realize that I love people. I love human connection. I love learning. I love growth. And I wasn't getting those needs met in the finance world. And I slowly started to feel like my soul was dying. It was just evaporating. And I started to get really miserable. And I joke around with people that I had two existential life crises by the time I was 25.
Wow. Yeah. I've heard people speak about the quarter life crisis, which is something that you're probably alluding to, but you had two of them.
Yep.
And what spurred the action? You know, we have a lot, I can imagine a lot of people in finance in that rat race are just putting their collar on like a leash and staying in it and just gritting their teeth and getting on with it. What made you do the outlier action, which was to step out of that and take a pivot?
Yeah. So there were two really important moments. The first was when, after working 1 year out of school, I quit my first job. And this was a big change, but it was also a safe change, because I was working in internal audit, which is kind of accounting, finance combined. And then I decided I wanted to quit and move more into traditional finance, because that's what I studied. So I quit my job, which was a big deal, but I had also studied for this big financial test and passed it and was like going to use that as my golden ticket to get the job I wanted. I moved cities. I moved down to San Diego. And that was a big change, but that was, again, kind of the safe change. That was when I was 23. And then I worked in finance down here for 2 years. And then that's when the big one, the quarter life crisis, happened. And that was when, in June of 2020, at the height of the pandemic, I had no idea what I wanted to do next with my life, but I knew I couldn't stay. And the fear of whatever was going to come next was eclipsed by the pain of staying the same. And that's when I quit my job with no plan. I told the CEO of my company that I was leaving to start a personal development company, just because I was too embarrassed to tell him I had no idea what I was doing. And that was the first time in my life I ever leaned into the unknown. And it was really the first bold action I ever took.
And what was going through your mind leading up to that when you were deciding on taking the bold action? Because that could eat you up for years, but it seems like, how quickly did you go from "this sucks, I need to change it" to "okay, I'm changing it, I'm starting the personal development company"?
Yeah, I would like to say that it was overnight. It was super quick and decisive, but it wasn't. It actually began at the end of 2019. I was in Japan with eight of my college best friends. And I had this rock bottom moment where after a night of heavy drinking at a karaoke hotel, I was sitting in the hostel violently hungover. And I was listening to Tim Ferriss, who we were talking about before this. I was listening to him talk about this research done by an Australian nurse named Bronnie Ware. And she sat with over 500 people on their deathbed and asked them, hey, you're almost at the end of this life. Do you have any regrets? And she found out that not only do most of people have serious end-of-life regret, but that everyone kept saying the same five things over and over again. And I'm sitting there violently hungover, like pretty upset with myself, being like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you don't even like drinking anymore, but you're still doing it because your friends want you to.
Yeah.
And I hear this. The number one regret of the dying is I wish I would have had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. And that just punched me in the face. And so that was November 2019. I heard that and I was like, okay, I'm going all of 2020 sober and I'm going to quit my job in finance in 2020. I have to do this. Otherwise, I am on the fast track to end of life regret. So that happened at the end of 2019. Throughout the first half of the year of 2020, I was in a personal development course offered by Aubrey Marcus. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Rings a bell. It does ring a bell.
Yeah, I used to be more into him. He founded this cool exercise, wellness, total human optimization company called Onnit. He's now kind of more in the spiritual realm. But he had this program that was basically just helping you find out what your mission is, what your purpose is. It was called Go For Your Win. And it was through that program that I started to think about what I wanted to do next and kind of build some of that courage. And then I finally got the courage to quit my job when I heard this quote by Charles Bukowski that was brutally negative. I always thought that it would be something positive and inspiring me that finally gave me the courage to quit. And it was really just the negative and realizing that if I didn't make a change, I would be stuck there forever.
What was the quote?
It's super long. I won't read you the whole thing, but it's a passage. If anyone listening, go Google Charles Bukowski 9-to-5 quote. He basically talks about how the 9-to-5 is modern day slavery.
Yeah.
And that employers never pay the slaves enough to be free, just enough to keep coming back to work. And that this is a cycle that we pass down to our children. And he's basically just ranting. And he's like, what do we do this for? And it was brutal. And that was the final moment. I was like, I'm doing it. I don't care what happens next. I can't stay. Anything is going to be better than going into the office every day and feeling like I'm letting myself down because I don't have the courage to make a change.
Yeah. It's so interesting how negativity and resent or fear or the chip on your shoulder is the thing that actually drives you to go into the unknown, right? We always, like you said, think it'd be some happy rainbow quote that would send us over the edge, but we actually often need something to run away from, right? To get us to achieve our goals or take the unknown route.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. And after you change your career, what's the next 6 months looking like for you? What's the next 12 months looking like for you?
Yeah. So I took an interesting path, which was, and I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I have found throughout the past 5 years, I've been on this journey to prove that the universe rewards bold action. And this was the first instance where I started to get some breadcrumbs, some winks from the universe that is true. And so as soon as I put my 2 weeks in to my financial company, I was connected to a stranger on the internet and we started a nonprofit together. So I left my job in finance. 2 weeks later, I was working more hours co-founding a nonprofit, but I was so fulfilled and alive because this was something that I was so passionate about. And it was making personal development part of education. And we were partnering with professional leadership coaches and pairing them with underserved high school students to show that working with a coach, and then we also created an evidence-based personal development program, that those two things in one semester could drastically and significantly change the course of a high schooler's trajectory. So we were able to show that meeting with a coach increased leader identity, growth mindset, resilience, all these things that are super important, especially in the schools we were working with.
So you said it was a stranger on the internet. How did you come into contact with them and actually arrange this?
I mentioned that personal development program that I was doing, and it was basically all of us in a big Facebook group. There's like 3,000 people around the world. And every week there was an assignment of like, the first one was like, what's your mission statement? What's your vision? Like we were just going through these things. And I had a woman reach out to me in the group, and she just sent me a Facebook message and she said, "Hey, my name's Sabrina. I know you don't know me, but I have to introduce you to this other guy who you don't know named Tim, who's actually not even in this program, but he's in this coaching program that I'm doing elsewhere. And he lives in San Diego. You live in San Diego. Can I connect you to?" So it was literally a stranger reaching out to me on the internet to connect me with another stranger.
Wow.
And I FaceTimed Tim. We hit it off. We met up and literally started the nonprofit together the week after that. And that was the first moment where I felt like the universe was conspiring to help me on my path, and where things stopped making sense. Like, what are the odds of that happening? That as soon as I finally muster up the courage to quit my job, I meet the next perfect person to help me on the path. And that has been a pattern that happens again and again and again. And that's why I say that the universe rewards bold action. If it sees you getting out of your comfort zone and really listening to your inner alignment, man, you meet the right people, the right doors, the right opportunities come out of nowhere.
And the trap that a lot of people fall into, and I'm sure your clients do a lot as being a personal coach that you are, is seeking the external metrics of success, the external validation, and going down that path. Maybe like you were maybe going down when you were going down the finance route, you got to get a lot of status and a lot of wealth from that position. How do we figure out what's intrinsic to us and what's an external superficial goal to go to avoid? So, and how do we then direct ourselves to the internal goals that actually will give us some sense of fulfillment?
Such a good question. And I am not the first person to think about this in history. And someone that I love to point to for questions like this is Viktor Frankl.
He was this
amazing Austrian psychiatrist. He survived two concentration camps during World War II and created this amazing philosophy called logotherapy. But he said that we all have this inner guidance, and he called it your conscience. And his advice to his students, because they'd always ask him, how do I be happy? How do I be successful? And he would say, do not focus on happiness and success. Rather, listen to what your conscience commands you to do and follow that. And that has been so true in my own life. We all have this inner voice that's guiding us. And if we listen to that, even when it's uncomfortable, even when we don't know how it's going to turn out, that in my experience and in my clients' experience is when we get the things that we want. The happiness, the meaning, the fulfillment, the purpose, the sense of aliveness. Those things can't be obtained directly, but they come to us as a byproduct from going after our dreams and listening to that voice. And that voice is really there to tell you, hey, we care about this. I think that inner voice is your soul. And it's saying, this is important to us. Go down this path. And it can be very hard at times because that voice is quiet and the other voices in your head, the inner critic, they yell. They're very loud. So to answer your question directly of how to know what is external versus internal, I think you have to get quiet with yourself and really pay attention. You can journal, you can meditate. At the end of the day, if you slow down long enough, you will know. Like everyone knows, they're like, oh, there's this gut feeling, this urge, this instinct. People call it different things. But usually we know what that is saying. And in my experience, I will know what that is saying and I will try and ignore it for like 6 months. It's like the gut versus the mind. And my gut is undefeated in being right. But I always take about 3 to 6 months for my mind to finally accept that that's true, because usually it's inconvenient. I would have to make a change or have an uncomfortable conversation. So checking in with yourself is really the only way to figure out whether you're being externally or internally driven.
100%. Sitting there alone with your thoughts can really solve a lot of the world's problems, because if everyone did that, I think a lot of people would be doing the internal things. Dude, it took me like at least 6 months, probably even 12 months or 18 months or 24 months, 2 years to start this podcast. Like I thought my gut was telling me to do it, but then my brain was saying, oh, you don't have the equipment. You don't know how it works. So it's going to be too expensive. You're too young. You're not smart enough. You don't know enough like famous or successful people. But finally, like you said, for yourself, my gut kicked in, was like, nope, just start it. And then as soon as I took the action, which is, I didn't do a to-do list. I just thought, okay, how do I actually record this and how can I do it remotely? Because I know Chris Williamson and Tim Ferriss have done remote episodes. As soon as I took that one little action, it just compounded after that and I didn't stop, because as soon as I start doing something and do it every single day, that's when I get the most success and stay consistent with things. But it's just that first little just action and the climbing over the wall, it seems like it's Mount Everest, but as soon as you get over that, it's just so much easier, isn't it? Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Yeah, and that's really the most important first step. So I have a podcast. I've been doing it for 5 years. It's called the Dare to Dream podcast. And I do it with one of my best friends, Vinny. And that is literally the thing we say over and over and over again, is just start. Just take that first step. Stephen King says that the scariest moment is right before you begin. After that, things can only get better. And I want to ask you, so what actually helped you scale that wall and start, make the first episode?
So I was walking back from either uni or work or something like that, or the gym, and it had been in the back of my mind. And I think one of the biggest things that was hard for me was, like I said, recording it and also figuring out how could I get guests on? Why would guests want to listen to me, right? But then I also listened to this other podcast. I don't know if you heard it, called Founders by David Senra. It's a solo.
Oh, yeah, I have.
Yeah. He's like, does solo episodes where he reads books. And I'd been reading a lot of the books that he'd recommended, or my own books. And I was like, okay, I don't know how to get guests on the show. That's too high friction. That's going to take too much activation energy. What's the best alternative that I can just do to get me started so then I can eventually get guests on? And it was to do a solo episode with a book. The first 5 episodes of the show is me in this room talking at the camera, summarizing a book. So it was that small action. And then after that, I then got the courage and the proof, which I think is really important. I'm sure you do as well. The proof that I gave me confidence to then get guests onto the show. So that's how I started. Tried to make it as low friction as possible, basically.
I love that. My first episode with Vinny was a Zoom call, not even video. It was literally just audio between the two of us. And I was so nervous. I was like shaking. And we didn't even end up publishing that because it was so bad.
Wow.
But even the first one that is live, if you YouTube the Dare to Dream podcast, it's so bad and it's hilarious. And I recently, maybe like a couple months ago, I did a post where it was like a couple seconds of the first episode and then it was a couple seconds of like episode 230. And
yeah,
that has been the most meaningful thing in my life. Not just saying the podcast, but any sort of journey I've gone on where I've started terribly and I've gotten at least to average. That to me has been the things that have brought me the most meaning, joy, fulfillment, way more than hitting some of these like external metrics of success. So going on a journey is like my favorite thing. I think it's one of the most important things we can do in life.
Yes, we're very growth orientated and we use the goal as, I guess, almost like a compass, but like a goal post. But the best part of doing it is actually the process of doing it rather than achieving the thing that you think will give you all the happiness in the world. And once you do get your first nugget of success or your first trophy, which is external, and you don't really feel much different after it, you realize, oh, the process of coming here was actually the best part of it, wasn't it? Have you experienced that quite a lot so far in your life?
Yes. And that was actually a huge change in my thinking this year, because I've been somewhat frustrated with goals over the past couple of years because I've been hitting a lot of them. And then you hit the goal, maybe you celebrate for like 2 minutes, but then the next day you're like, what's next? And then now, okay, that goal is now the new minimum mark. If you do something again, like say you record an episode and it gets 10,000 views, 50,000 views. If your next episode doesn't get more than 50,000 views, you're like, damn, I'm moving backwards.
Yeah.
So one of the biggest breakthroughs this year in my own thinking was realizing that the goal of setting a goal is not to achieve it. It's simply to give you a journey to go on.
Yeah.
Because you do actually need a goal to give you direction. Otherwise, you're just like, oh, what should I do? What journey should I go on? So for me and for my clients, we set the goal and then we ignore it and we just go on the journey. And then when the goal happens, when we hit the goal or the goal doesn't happen, it doesn't even matter because you get all of the growth and the fulfillment and the ups and the downs and the life that comes from going after it.
100%, 100% agree. And how do we actually celebrate for longer than 2 minutes? You know, because it's the hedonic treadmill, isn't it? We just return to baseline so quickly.
Yeah.
And some of us are lucky to have quite optimistic baselines. But imagine if you're severely depressed as your baseline, but you're also a very type A high achiever and you achieve the goal that you think will make you happy or you said would make you happy. And then you return to that low baseline. Are there any ways that you found that has enabled you to be more fulfilled when you do reach the goal and then continue the journey after that?
Two things come to mind. One is whenever I'm working with my clients, I always ask the question at the end, how are you going to celebrate this? And everyone always says, because I work with a lot of kind of type A high achievers, everyone's always like, oh, I didn't even think about that. Let me think about that and I'll get back to you. And then I'm like, no, like, tell me now. We're going to come up with a celebration.
Yeah.
And especially, I mentioned earlier, I went all of 2020 sober. I ended up going 2021 sober because I felt so good. And then the years after that, I was kind of just seeing how alcohol fit into my life. Now it's just not in my life because I value health and waking up early and all these things. And I don't have anything against drinking, but I just don't do it anymore. And that's where the question, how are you going to celebrate, gets tricky. Because usually like people think, oh, celebration, like I'll go out, you know, drink some champagne, do all these things. So for me personally, celebration has been asking the question, what's one thing that I would absolutely love to do that feels like a guilty pleasure that I could give myself the time to go do? So maybe that's, I'm going to take a day off of work and I'm going to surf and just play pickleball and go to the gym and just do the things I love.
Yeah.
Or maybe I can book a little trip for myself, for me and my girlfriend, or what we do a lot of the times when we're celebrating my accomplishments or hers, we'll just go to a nice dinner and like treat ourselves that way. But it is so hard to keep the celebration factor going. Again, it does feel quick, but again, reflecting on the journey has been my biggest sense of meaning and fulfillment. So when I do hit something, yes, do a celebration, but then go back and try and find, and luckily for us, we record podcasts. So we have like video evidence of how bad we used to be.
Yeah.
But for me, the celebration has been to really, instead of looking forward at what's next, look backwards and just appreciate the growth and the courage and the effort it took to get from where you used to be to where you are now. And this is actually a concept that's been really helpful in my life. It's called the reverse gap. Most people look at where they want to go compared to where they are today. And they say, oh man, I'm so far away. I have so far to go, so many things to overcome. But we hardly ever look backwards and
so
look
true.
At that gap and be like, wow, I've come so far.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, that made me actually do the reverse gap and realize, oh my God, I haven't done that. You know, I was like, 3 years ago was very, very, well, I didn't go to the gym, so I was super skinny, which I was self-conscious about, had like long blonde hair, anxious, didn't know how to talk to new people, talk to girls, was doing photography, but not the podcast or anything. I hadn't found out about really self-improvement or do any reading or anything. I was not on the intrinsic path. That was partly because I was still in school, but that's another thing that we've all overcome and has helped us, because I think when you're in school, they do try and make you go down that beaten track, and it can be very hard to get out of that, right? And I think one of the best things you can do and one of the most courageous things you can do is try and do the opposite of what school says. Like, I'm sure school didn't tell you to become a life coach or personal coach, did they?
No, school did not. I mean, that wasn't even like in the vocabulary, but even, I love telling this story. So my mom is the best. Like my parents are amazing. But even my mom, when I first told her, we were on a walk, on the boardwalk, and I remember this moment. And I had been thinking about this concept of becoming a life coach and I was scared to share it with someone. And I always tell my clients that whenever we share our dreams with people for the first time, we need to make sure that it's in a safe, supportive environment.
Yeah.
Because how it is received in that first moment is really important. So I'm with my mom and I like muster up the courage to bring out this dream. And I'm like, hey, mom, I think maybe I want to be a life coach. And she goes, you can't be a life coach. You're too young. And so then I take this dream back and I put it back on the shelf and I don't look at it for the next year. And so sharing your dreams with people is a scary process, and doing it with the right people is really important. So yeah, it was not in the vocabulary. It wasn't on the radar for a long time.
Yeah. You carry on.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So you said you're 21, right?
Yes.
That's Gen Z?
Yes, it is actually, yeah. I get mixed up. It is Gen Z, yeah.
Okay. What is after Gen Z?
Gen X, I think. Or Gen Alpha. I'm bad with that stuff, but yeah.
Anyways, the question I want to ask is, what is with you guys in Gen Z? Because you're 21 and I've had the privilege of hanging out with a lot of 19-year-old Gen Zers in this community I lead called the Bold Action Community. But dude, all of you guys are dialed. You're going to the gym, you have a business, you seem to know where you're going in life. And I would just love to hear from your perspective where that comes from. Is that social pressure through social media to have it all together? Do you feel like you're just getting into all of this stuff earlier because you have better access?
Yeah.
Because like, dude, when I was like, my personal development journey did not start until I graduated college. I think the first podcast I ever listened to, the first like personal development book I picked up was, I was probably 22 or 23. And now people are getting into it at like 13.
Yeah. Yeah. No, my godbrother's 6 years younger than me. He's so dialed at 15. It's crazy. I'm so happy for him. And he's like, I try and teach him and he teaches me stuff now, which is awesome. Shout out to Jack. But yeah, I think it's access. I think it's mainly access. And also you said the social media thing, but I think that is again, access. So like, even when I wasn't into self-improvement, I hadn't started going to the gym. Also lockdown helped, like it helped for you. So lockdown was a pivotal moment for me where I was like, okay, I don't hang out with these people in school anymore. I'm going to get a camera. Instead, I'm going to go out in nature again, because going out in nature wasn't cool, but because it was lockdown, I could do that. So I combined nature and photography. So I wanted to become a nature photographer. And then I started an Instagram account because I could see that other nature photographers were doing that and getting followers and being successful from it, which is a bit extrinsic, but it was still inspirational for me. And then I'd listen to this rapper from Wales who's got like millions of plays from recording on GarageBand on his iPhone, which was like a cracked iPhone 5. And I loved his music and he succeeded from his bedroom. So I could do that, right? And then I got into the gym after being rejected by a girl. And then I started listening to self-improvement gym content. And then I found Modern Wisdom. And then I read The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss when I was 18. And it just snowballed from there. So I think it was just availability and access, because like you said, it took you longer maybe because there wasn't as much podcasts and books and stuff. But even thinking of my parents' generation, like they would have just grown up with what was around them and maybe some books. So it's really helped to actually have social media. And if you can use social media the right way by channeling that attention on social media to self-improvement or whatever you find interesting, which isn't sapping your attention span, I think you can have a serious advantage.
I appreciate that answer so much, because two things come to mind. One is that, yeah, it seems like every generation people are starting earlier. Like my dad looks at me and he's like, stop thinking so much. Like you don't need to know the answer to what is the meaning of life at your age. And over the years, he's kind of just like realized that that's what I love. I love asking these deep questions.
Yeah. But
he was always like, dude, just chill out. Like chill out, do good work, things will happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm always like, do I need to set goals and my vision and what's my purpose and all these things. But I love that you brought up COVID, because COVID was such a big shift in my life and so many people I talk to. And it makes sense now. I've never thought about it through that lens, but it makes sense that it would kind of put a lot of people in the, I don't know, 16 to 22 range. It would act as a catalyst for them to start thinking, okay, what actually makes me happy now that I don't have all of these external obligations and constraints. Now I can kind of get to know myself a little bit more. So that's cool. I've never thought about it that way.
Yeah, it's just such a big pattern interrupt. And I never really liked school that much. I didn't do bad in school, but I didn't really like it. I didn't like the conformity and the authority. I'm sure you probably didn't either. But being away from that, like you said, it gives you more time to think about these things and think about what you genuinely want to do with your life away from the judgment of others. Because when you're in that age, you're still acutely aware of other people's opinions of you because you have to see them 5 times a week in a classroom. And yep. You don't want to get bullied. You want to fit in to some degree. And it takes a while for you to shed that skin. But a lot of people go straight from school to the office, like you were saying. And that's basically another version of school in the sense that it is a kind of a tribe and people will be thinking and judging you. Whereas nowadays with the internet, you could just go monk mode for a year or two, go through the lonely chapter, go to the gym, start a business on your laptop by yourself and not have as many people judging you, and then come out the other side much more dialed in, I guess. So I think that's what's kind of happening. But caveat, it's kind of availability bias. There's a lot of people I know my age that are still taking the beaten path. I think 99% of people still are doing that. But I think you're just seeing the outliers appear or emerge at a younger age. I don't think necessarily the percentage of people are increasing that much. There's still a lot of people just doing the normal stuff, drinking and having a normal office job, which is fine if you're that way inclined. But yeah, that's what I think.
I love that.
Yeah. And in terms of self-doubt, how are you dealing with self-doubt now you have more proof of your concept of your dreams, of your goals, you know, being a life coach, the TED talk, the podcast, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, self-doubt is a bitch. And it's something that is always there. And especially for me, I have a really strong inner critic. So it is constantly in my ear. And especially now that, like you said, I do have some kind of external proof. And to let listeners know, I gave a TEDx talk back in March called How Being Bold Will Change Your Life. And I haven't checked it in a couple of days, but we've crossed 320,000 views, which for a TEDx talk puts me in the top 1% of TEDx talks out there, because most never get more than 5,000 views.
Yeah.
So that is freaking cool. And at the same time, man, I have days where I'm like, did I actually give that talk? Like, was that real or is that a dream? And it's been such a blessing. I mean, it's how we met. Like, you showed up in my email inbox because you watched it.
Yeah,
it's
really
connected
good.
Me to so many amazing people. And yet I still have self-doubt. But I would say the self-doubt now is in such a better place than it used to be because I've just taken action. So Alex Hormozi, who I'm sure you've heard of.
Love him.
He talks about outworking your self-doubt.
Yeah.
And that you don't become confident by shouting affirmations in the mirror. You become confident by having this irrefutable stack of proof that you are who you say you are. And that has been such a powerful idea in my mind, is that confidence is built through action, and confidence is built through you saying the thing, or sorry, you doing the thing you said you're going to do.
Yeah.
So even if it's, hey, I'm going to wake up at 5:30 tomorrow and I'm going to be in the gym by 6. You do that for 3 weeks in a row, you will be confident because you can trust yourself. And so I've had a lot of people reach out to me around wanting to build confidence, because that is really a key component of taking bold action and getting what you want in life, which is what I help people with. And the self-doubt is there when I think about, again, bringing it back to where I am now versus where I want to go. But if I do that reverse gap that we talked about earlier, the self-doubt quiets down a little bit, because I have, to borrow from Chris Williamson's vocabulary, I've achieved some escape velocity from my old life. And this is actually, it's all tied together. You just mentioned that I'm getting to see the people who are no longer working the 9-to-5. I'm talking to people like you who are an outlier because of the field that I'm in now. And getting to surround myself with people who are the outliers and who are doing the cool things, I think has really helped with the self-doubt too, because it shows me that I am kind of one of those outliers as well.
Yeah.
And when you surround yourself with people who are going after it, self-doubt isn't that scary, and it's not this crippling thing anymore, because all of my friends who are entrepreneurs have the self-doubt too. And we're like, oh yeah, like I used to have the problem of, I hate my job. I don't know what to do with my life. What do I do next? And now it's like, I love my job. I absolutely love the work I get to do with clients, but how can I grow it even more?
Yeah.
So different problems, but I would way rather have these problems because I'm showing up excited and eager to solve them versus when I was in the corporate world and I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I was so hopeless.
But do the voices get more quiet once you reach some escape velocity, or is it just because you're shifting the goal, it persists just in a different manifestation?
The voice has gotten less strong around certain things.
Yeah.
Because it is, I've proven that I can be successful in a very difficult field, coaching. I mean, everyone and their mom is a life coach on the internet. And it wasn't really until end of last year, I feel like I closed the chapter on, can I make it as a coach? Because I made more money from coaching than I did when I worked in finance, which was like this huge milestone for me.
Yeah.
So now again, I have doubt about so many things, but it does feel quieter and it does feel less scary because I have become the person who can do the scary things. And I think that is such an important thing to think about, is that yes, achieving your goals is important, but I believe that one of the most important things in life is who we are becoming.
Yeah, 100%. And how can we stay consistent at the goals, even during periods when the sign of success is so elusive? You know, you're mentioning how you've now made more money, which is fucking awesome. Well done. But what about before that, the in-between period, maybe the lonely chapter after the job, but then before that success, that milestone, how do you stay consistent during that period?
Oh, it's freaking brutal. You have to decide why you're doing things. Being connected to the why is always going to help you keep going. And for me, when it was starting out as a coach, I was so sure that I wanted to do this because I loved the way that good coaches showed up and how they helped people. And I knew that as long as I didn't quit, at some point I would be successful in it. Mm-hmm. And realizing too, another Hermosism is realizing that this is what hard feels like.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've heard him talk about that, but basically being like, the beginning of anything, whether you're starting a podcast, you're starting a coaching company, you're starting a manual labor company or a painting company or whatever it is, like the first, I don't want to put labels on it, but like the first 2 years, maybe it's 6 months if everything goes great. But that first part is super hard because you haven't taken enough action to have that identity of this is what I do. You're still trying to figure it out. There's a period where you are toiling in obscurity. I can't remember who said that, but I love that because
that's so good.
You are posting content, you're writing articles, you're recording podcasts, and no one's listening. And the fact is people are listening, but they aren't telling you yet. They're lurkers.
Yeah.
You'll get so many people who have been like, oh, I've been following your stuff for like 3 years. And you're like, why didn't you say anything? Like, I had no idea. I was so alone. I almost quit so many times. And it would have been helpful if I would have known. So thanks for not saying anything. But it's that period of toiling in obscurity where you have no external feedback from the world on if you're doing it right, if you're doing a good job. And the way to stay consistent is to view consistency as a goal. Just be like, literally, my only goal here is to be consistent, to prove to myself that I'm serious about this, that I'm going to do the things I say I want to do. And again, just knowing why you're doing it. If you love podcasting, which I can tell you do, and you're using it to have amazing conversations and explore yourself and meet cool people, you're gonna do it regardless of what the external world is saying. And so finding those things, it sounds super cliche, but finding the things that you would do for free and doing them long enough to where you no longer have to do them for free and you get paid for, that has been very helpful in my life too.
Yeah, I think, was it Naval that said, do things that look like work to others, but feel like play to you? And another, yes. I kind of repurposed the Hormozyism when you went with the, this is what hard feels like, and branched off as a few weeks ago, I was thinking like, no one said it would be fast. No one said it would be an overnight thing, right? And it feels like something Hormozy would say. And it's really stuck with me when I was just walking down the street thinking about it. Cause it's like, yeah, you might get the successful episode, like you were saying, where it's like 10,000 views or 50,000 views, but that's, you got to do it again if that's what you want. And no one said the process, the journey, like we've been talking about, would be quick. And if it was quick, like we were saying with the shifting goalposts and the hedonic treadmill, you'd probably quit sooner if all the rewards came easy to you and came quickly, right? Because if something feels easy, we kind of get lazy about it. We rest on our laurels. And if it's something that's not too close, but not too far away, and it's just out of grasp, I think that's like the sweet spot that can enable us to continue. And when you were talking about the consistency thing as well, I think it's good to define things like consistency or courage, which I'm going to ask you in about in a second. But when I think of consistency, because it's something I used to struggle with, and I didn't want that to be the case for this show. I just think, what is consistency? Well, if you're consistent, you don't stop. So just don't stop. Just don't stop the podcast. And I repeat that mantra in my head so many times a day. Just don't stop. Just don't stop. Just don't stop. So how would you define courage, for example?
I got to comment on that first real quick.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's great. That is what I repeated to myself when I was in the darker chapters of building a coaching business. It was literally, this is what hard feels like. It's supposed to be hard. No one ever said it was going to be easy.
Yeah.
There's a quote, there's a clip of, I think it's LeBron in an interview just being like, no one ever said it was going to be easy.
Yeah.
And Vinny and I, my co-host, we would always say that to each other.
Yeah.
But if you don't stop, if you never quit, you can't fail. Because
mm-hmm. yep.
you're still moving forward. There's still, it might be a small probability of success, but it is not gone until you actually quit. So not stopping, I think, is a beautiful way to define consistency. And really asking yourself, what does consistent mean for you? Is it doing the thing you say you want to do once a week, twice a week, four times a week? Again, it depends on whether you're going to the gym or recording a podcast. How I define courage, this is not an original thought. I've heard this from a lot of other people, but courage is taking action despite the fear.
Yeah.
So if you're taking action and you're not scared, it's not courage. Mm-hmm. If you are terrified, and I call this taking terrified action. If you are so afraid, your palms are sweaty, your pits are sweaty, you're literally shaking and you're nervous, and you act, that's courage.
Yeah.
And so much of what we want in life is on the other side of 10 seconds of taking terrified action. It's how I met my girlfriend, who is the love of my life, and we live together now. It's how so many of these amazing things in my life have shown up. It's just feeling the fear and doing it anyways. That's like an old school personal development book. But that's been huge for me, is realizing that we're never going to defeat or vanquish or banish our fear. But you can feel the fear and still take action and just be like, yeah, I'm scared right now. And I'm still going to talk to this girl. I'm still going to make this business pitch.
Yeah. Doing the action despite the fear is a really good way of, again, saying this is what hard feels like. No one said it was easy, because it gives you the excuse to be okay with the fact that you're scared and still take the action anyway. Because a lot of the time, when we're doing these actions, maybe if we were in a group setting, you would be accused of being like a wimp if you said you were scared. But in reality, courage is doing the thing, even though you're nervous, that allows you to be okay and be content with the fact that you're scared and also do it anyway. And also, do you think the reason why it's leads to success a lot of the time when you do courageous actions is that because if it was easy, everyone would be doing it? Therefore, because you did it, it's a therefore rare thing, and therefore you get an outsized return?
I think yes, for sure. There's a selection bias, like a lot of people aren't going to do it. But two, this kind of falls into the literally false, metaphorically true category. But I have this whole thing I teach in some of my workshops, that the universe rewards bold action. And that if you consistently take bold action, this shift happens. I call it the magical shift. And you shift from linear progress, where 1 + 1 = 2, to exponential progress, where 1 + 1 = 12. And I can't explain it. I don't know what's going on at a metaphysical level. But the more consistent times I get out of my comfort zone, the more I have these mind-bending moments where something happens that should not have happened. I meet the co-founder of my nonprofit through a stranger on the internet exactly when I turn my 2 weeks in. I finally commit to hosting an in-person retreat. And 3 days later, I meet a woman who asks me if I want to, if I'd ever be interested in hosting retreats and if I want to use her retreat center for free. Like wow. These things that should not add up and statistically should be impossible. I've had so many of these happen. They happen all the time in my client's life too. And so I call that the magical shift. So I think that's at play too, when we take courage. And then I want to go back to what you said real quick about being called a wimp. And if you're in a group setting, I've learned this lesson through my life that if someone asks you to do something scary, if you can just jump in and do it, it's so much better. And what I mean by this, going back to my co-founder for the nonprofit, he loved to freestyle. And whenever he drove me around or anyone else around, he would always put a beat on and he'd be like, all right, it's your turn to freestyle, go. And if you hesitate, if you hem and haw and you're like, no, I don't want to do it. Even if you end up doing it, but you like hesitate for 30 seconds, like no one's impressed. And then it's even more awkward. There's just all this pressure. If instead, I saw this one time, our Uber driver, he's like, hey, I'm playing a beat in the back, freestyle. And the Uber driver just went for it, just like jumped in. It was not good, but we were both like so impressed because there was just no hesitation. So anytime like a friend dares you to do something, obviously use your discretion. Don't do anything ridiculously dumb. But if you can just like jump in right away, even if you do poorly, people will respect it because you went for it.
Mm. Is that the 10-second rule?
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a version of that for sure.
Mm. Could you elaborate for the listeners what the 10-second rule is?
So I've heard of the 5-second rule from Mel Robbins. Are we talking about the same thing, or something different?
Yeah, same thing.
So she basically says, when you think of an idea or there's an opportunity presented, you have 5 seconds to take action on it before you lose that inspiration, that fuel. Mm. And I think it's the same thing. And there's a added bonus or an added benefit to those who take action without hesitation in those first 5 seconds. That, like I said, even if you end up doing the freestyle, but you've like put it off for 2 minutes and you've complained about how you can't possibly do it, even if you crush it, people are going to remember that you kind of hesitated for so long.
Mm, yeah. And did you do the 100-day rejection challenge?
I did. That was a key part of my own journey. So to make a very long story short, I met my girlfriend at a cafe by going up to her, interrupting the table she was sitting at. She was sitting with a guy and another girl. And I said, hey, you're really cute, which means you probably have a boyfriend. If you don't, here's my phone number. And I had wrote my phone number on the back of a receipt and I gave it to her. She ended up texting me. We fell in love. End of story. No, it's a long story, but that worked so well. That was just at the beginning of my formulation of two things. One, that fortune favors the bold is not just a cool quote, but it's a formula for how the universe works. Mm. And then being like, okay, that worked. I can't believe this girl at the cafe texted me. I need to go test this. So I had read Jia Jiang's book, Rejection Proof, and I had this idea that I wanted to test. And so it was like a hypothesis that I needed to test like a scientist. I needed more. I needed a larger sample size. So that's when I went. And for 100 days around San Diego, I tried to get rejected by strangers in the most outrageous ways possible.
Mm, what was the most outrageous one in that challenge?
The most outrageous one that was successful was on day 4. And I'm so grateful that this happened at the beginning because I had wind in my sails for the rest of it. On day 4, I knocked on a stranger's door and I asked if I could jump in his swimming pool. And he said, yes. And not only that, we filmed a 10-second video of it, me cannonballing in the stranger's swimming pool. And I posted it on Instagram and it went viral. And so for the next 96 days of my challenge, I literally had hundreds of thousands of people following along and encouraged me and giving me all of these ideas. Like, hey, I was like, what should I do next? And they were like, do this. So that was the best one that was successful and also one of my favorites because that created a rule for me. I made up a rule where any idea that I had that popped into my head that made me laugh out loud, I had to do it. Because that one, I was just sitting in my room being like, okay, what am I going to do today? When can I go out and talk to people? And then like, for whatever reason, I was just like, what if I tried to jump in someone's swimming pool? And I just laughed out loud and I was like, all right, game time, let's go.
Yeah. And do you think, again, it's just that reps and exposure therapy when it comes to getting over that rejection or increasing your level of courage.
100%. So rejection therapy is what Jia Jing has created because of this. And it's exposure therapy. It's literally what you do if you work with a therapist and you have arachnophobia and you're afraid of spiders. You will slowly introduce spiders into your life and sit with the fear and overcome it. And so that's the beauty of doing a 100-day rejection challenge, which 100 days is a long time.
Yeah.
Warning. But you just get used to it. And then you start to realize that if people reject you, it's fine. And even if you get rejected, the other person's usually laughing. You share this little moment. And this led to probably the most important thing in my life, which is this mantra and life philosophy that's called live a story worth telling. That is my mission in life. My mission in life is to live a story worth telling while helping others do the same. And that to me is everything. It involves taking bold action, going after your dreams, having fun, and ultimately at the end of life, having all of these stories to tell yourself and others, not in a fancy Instagram showboating way, but just to be an interesting person who, when you're at a cocktail party and someone is talking about rejection, or say they are talking about South America, you can be like, oh yeah, like I went on a surf trip there. Like it's a story worth telling.
Yeah, definitely. And how do you implement courage and, I guess, overcoming rejection? How do you maintain that once you finish the 100 days of rejection? How are you still implementing it in different ways today?
Two things come to mind. One is I have Live a Story Worth Telling, I don't know if you can see it, tattooed on my arm, right here on my forearm. And it's a little personal reminder facing me because my biggest fear used to be settling. I was so afraid when I worked in finance. I was so afraid that one day I would wake up and be 55, still working in finance and not even notice that I had settled and just have this horrible moment where I was like, what happened? So I got it tattooed on my arm, live a story worth telling. Because I have a harsh inner critic, I realized that I could not live with myself if I had this tattoo and decided to play a small life. So that is something called a commitment device, an action you can take in the present moment to lock in a desired future action. So I made this, took this action, got this tattoo in the present moment to lock in me having to live an extraordinary life. That's pretty extreme. The simpler answer is surround yourself with the right people. I lead a community called the Bold Action Community now. As the leader of the community, I can't just talk the talk. I have to walk the walk. So I constantly look to surround myself with people who inspire me and push me to think bigger so that I'm constantly facing my fears, making those bold actions and doing things that require courage.
Yeah. A lot of people my age, especially, and probably people older now as well, maybe people, this is a deathbed regret actually, is not finding their tribe. It's something I was very lustful about when I, and wistful about when I was in my teens and still am kind of to this day. So what's the practicality of reaching out and finding those people for you? How have you found these people? How do you connect them together? You mentioned your community, but in terms of even mentors, for example, as well, what does that look like for you?
When I was sad working in finance, I wanted a mentor so bad. You read all these personal development books and like they had the mentor who changed everything for them. And I'm still looking for that person. And I really, I've kind of actually let go of that. I have a bunch of different mentors. I think that whole find one person who's going to take you under their wing and show you the world, that feels kind of like a different generation.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But what I realized is it goes back to what we talked about in the beginning. You have to start doing what you love and showing up with your weirdness and your curiosity and your excitement. Because if you are just being yourself and being authentic, it's going to lead you into environments where your people are going to hang out and then they're going to really resonate with you. Because they're going to be like, oh, you too? Like, you also like this strange thing?
Yeah.
So if I would have just stayed in finance, I wouldn't have found my mentors because I wouldn't have found them in the coaching industry. I wouldn't have found them in the podcasting industry. I think the simplest way to find both friends and mentors is to just go do the things you love unapologetically. If you love pickleball, go play pickleball all the time. Like, you will make friends quickly. If you love podcasting, you have to start podcasting. And then we met because you reached out to me. Like, we are friends now. And that's the craziest thing is it's like, we want all of these friendships and connections, but you have to go first. You have to put yourself out there, and then people are going to find you and see you because of what you're doing, and then you'll get those connections.
Yeah, it's again almost not in the transactional sense. I don't want to get us mixed up in that sense, or the audience mixed up, but you need some, again, proof. Like if you love pickleball, start playing pickleball. And also that gives proof for others. It shows that you have some value to give to them, because you can then play pickleball together, or you can then podcast together. So it's not in the transactional sense, but it is good to think, okay, if I like bird watching, I should probably do some bird watching in my own time. And then when I bump into someone, well, I'll have a higher chance of bumping into someone at the nature reserve, and we'll both be aligned because we'll both be bird watching. Whereas compare that to just sitting in your room thinking, oh, I really love bird watching or pickleball or podcasting. I wish I could meet people who were into that. Like, you have to actually, again, take the action. It's just constantly, it seems to be just action bias, isn't it? Having a bias for action, right?
It is. That's literally, if we could boil everything that we've said on this podcast down into one sentence, it would be take bold action. And what you're saying is so true about just getting out in the world and doing the things you want, because you will meet the people who are interested in the same thing. I used to struggle. I hated going to bars, and I would go to bars and I'd be like, I never meet anyone cool at bars. Well, of course, I wasn't happy to be there. I wasn't being my authentic self. Mm-hmm. I was showing up as someone who is in a place where they don't want to be.
Yeah.
I'm not going to meet anyone there. But if you just lean into your quirks and your weirdness and the things you like, and go do those activities, you're gonna find people to connect with there, because them being at that event, there was all of these filters that they had to pass to get there.
Yeah.
Like I went to an ice bath group. It was a group of dudes who were meeting for multiple Saturdays at the beach at 7 a.m. to take ice baths. And if you just think about that for a moment, think about all of the people who were filtered out.
Yeah.
One, it's Saturday morning, so most people have plans. It's Saturday morning at 7 a.m. Most people are hungover from the night before. It's Saturday at 7 a.m. at the beach where it's cold and you're getting into a freaking ice bath. Mm. The person who shows up there, you're instantly going to bond with, because you crossed so many hurdles to get there.
Mm.
So find stuff like that. Find events that you can go to like that.
Yeah. Find events that have a very high and specific selection criteria. Yes. Yeah, because it's like talking to friends at university who are wistful that they don't have a long-term secure relationship, but then they're going out every single weekend to the pub and then to the club when they probably don't want to do that and are actually very into their fitness and their gym and they're outdoorsy. Well, maybe if you go to the gym on a Saturday at 7 a.m. and then you go up to a girl that you find cute, that might be a better strategy than going out at the club at 3 a.m., right? Again, it's just the selection criteria. And what questions should people ask themselves to change their life for the better? What are the most impactful questions we can ask ourselves?
I think what comes to mind right off the bat, we'll start here, asking yourself, what would my ideal day look like? Or what would my day look like if I had all the money in the world? If I never had to worry about money ever again, what would I do? And I asked myself that question recently because I've been feeling like I am saying yes to a lot of things. I have a lot on my plate. As the external accolades have provided more opportunities for me, I'm really trying to check in with myself and make sure that these are still what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, if I had $300 million in the bank, what would I do tomorrow? And I would go to the gym. I'd come home and I'd make a smoothie because I'm addicted to smoothies. I would go surfing. And then maybe from like noon to 4 p.m., I would post up at my office, or I don't even know if I'd have an office, or I'd go to a coffee shop and I would have office hours where I would be like, hey, come get free coaching. Like, you want coaching, you want connections, you just want to talk something through. Like, I'm here for you. I'm here to help.
Mm.
And then I would go home and I would cook dinner with my girlfriend or have like a friend's dinner. And so thinking about that helps me feel like, one, I'm exactly on the right track.
Yeah.
Because I am doing coaching as the primary part of my day. If I didn't need to make money, I would do it for less. I wouldn't coach for 8 hours a day because it's kind of exhausting. But two, I'm not surfing enough. So it made me realize, like, I always used to ask myself this question too. If I only had 6 months to live, what would I do? And the answer for that was always like, I would surf every day. And so asking those questions can help figure out what would you do essentially for free because you don't have to make money anymore? And what are the things that would really make your day ideal? Because our life is just a bunch of days over and over again. So if you're doing what I'm currently doing and having some awareness of it helps, but like right now I'm kind of sacrificing the surfing during the week so that I can grow my business. And I'm surfing on the weekends, which is fine. It's kind of a conscious choice.
Mm.
But ask yourself, what would I do if I had all the money in the world? I think is a really good place to start.
Mm. That's really good. And the idea of having that ideal day, but it's almost like your ideal Tuesday, right? Like it's the mundane day. What would your best mundane or everyday look like? And it obviously wouldn't be mundane if it was ideal, but I've done something similar myself as well. It's like, as long as I go to the gym, read a book and do the podcast. It used to be going out my camera, so it can be that as well, but mainly doing the podcast. If I do those three things every day, like that's good. And then if I go to the sauna or I have a nice meal with my girlfriend or I socialize, et cetera, that's great. But if I do those three pillars every single day, I know it will compound and that's what's happening. I have a 365 day grid that I cross off every time I do read, work out do the podcast. And the podcast isn't me doing an episode. It might be sending an email to you, inviting you to come onto the show. That counts. Because obviously you can burn yourself out if you just did a podcast 7 days a week for 365 days. But yeah, I agree with the pillar thing for sure.
Yeah, the pillar thing is super good. And another thing that comes to mind is ask yourself, what costs am I willing to pay? Mm. And what I mean by that is your dream lifestyle might have an associated cost.
Mm.
Let's use public speaking, for example. I thought for a moment that I wanted to become a professional speaker and speak all over. And then I started to meet and network with a lot of professional speakers and like some really big names who do it all the time. And I realized that, oh, if I want to do that, I'm going to be competing with them and I'm going to need to be on the road like 270, 300 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I reflected and I was like, wow, some of the things that make me the most happy are having a consistent gym routine, being at home here in San Diego. So like, I quickly realized that maybe that dream, air quotes, isn't actually one of my dreams because I'm not willing to pay those costs. So asking if I were to get everything I wanted with this career pursuit, with this business, would I actually like what my life looked like at the end of it? Your dream might be, I want to make $50,000 a month, but if the cost required to do that is you're working 12 hours a day and you're traveling and you don't have time to surf or play pickleball or read a book, that might actually suck.
Yeah, it's definitely a good caveat because people will fall into that trap without realizing. They'll jump into the pool and realize it's ice cold before they have time to get back out again. So it's very, very good caveat. And you mentioned the external accolades briefly, and we spoke about the TED Talk, but how has your life changed since the viral TED Talk? I've got this thing called, what is it called? It's this YouTube thing which shows you how well the video performs versus the channel's usual ones. And you said it's like, it's in the top 1%. Yeah, your video is the outlier score. It's got 100x the usual one. So congratulations. But how has your life changed, if at all, since that?
It has changed less than I imagined it would. And I think that's beautiful and frustrating at the same time.
Mm.
The positives are I have amazing people like yourself reach out now and I get to meet them. So I'm not doing as much of the work to reach out to people to build connections. I do have cool people coming in now, which is great. I've gotten a couple speaking opportunities from it. But the biggest thing, and it's like, I'll kind of even take a step back, like giving a TED Talk has been on my bucket list since I was like 15. I was like, I love TED Talks. And then I realized, okay, there's TED Talks, which are like a few number of people per year at TED in Seattle. And then there's TEDx, which is every big city has a independently organized TED event. And that's what people speak at if you're not a famous author, a celebrity, a scientist. So then I was like, okay, I want to give that. And crossing that off the bucket list has felt awesome. But the biggest thing it's done is shown me that all of these things that I want are possible.
Mm.
That has been probably the biggest change. is, and again, some days I'm like, damn, did I even do that? If I'm being honest. But the other days it's like, okay, I did that thing. This is something that was on my bucket list forever. Why not these other things? Why can't these other things happen too? So it's given me more belief in what's possible and also patience, because I don't know if you're familiar with Ben Nempton.
No.
He was one of the four original guys on this old MTV show in the 2000s or 2010 called The Buried Life. And they decided to buy this old bus and drive across the US and create a list of 100 things they wanted to do before they die. And they would do one of the things on their bucket list and then help a stranger do something. Mm. And he is one of the top public speakers in the world now. He's actually one of the people I talk to about what his life looks like. And where am I going with this? I completely blanked.
No worries.
Ben Nempton speaking. What were we talking about here?
We were saying how your life's changed since the TED Talk.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay, great. Well, we'll chop that part out. He was saying that, so he literally, his entire life changed because he gave a TEDx talk.
Mm.
He is one of the top public speakers in the world because of that. But his talk didn't get that many views and nothing happened for 2 years. Mm. So 2 years after it came out, he had someone watch it who was like, hey, I want you to come speak to my company. And then he went and made that one talk. And then someone in the audience saw it and was like, I want you to come to speak to my company.
Mm.
And so it was this compound effect that happened 2 years after it. And again, I'm 6 months into mine being out. And some days I'm like, damn, so many cool things are happening, but maybe not as much as I expected.
Mm.
So patience, having patience. That's where I was going with the whole thing, is you never know how long it's going to take for certain things to come true. And that's why I'm a big believer in kind of having multiple dreams going at once. So you can, they can come through at different times.
Yeah, 100%. And it's TED Talks are so evergreen as well. And the fact that yours is an outlier means it's probably going to continue to compound and you'll get more attraction from that, which is awesome. And as a final question for you, Gregory, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
Oh, it's such a good question. And I'm so biased on this because the people that we like listening to, Chris Williamson, other people in that space have been kind of shitting on this question recently, because the advice that you need at the beginning of your journey is very different than the advice you need when you're successful, air quotes. Mm. Because the advice you need at the beginning might not be, oh, work less hard, take it easy on yourself. Like that's what all these people say when they're super successful and you're hearing about Tim Ferriss's day and he walks for like 6 hours a day and you're like, that's awesome. That's awesome for you now. But like, that's probably not what you were doing when you were starting your thing. So all of that context aside, I would say focus on the journey, not the destination. And realize that there's this Seneca quote that I love. And he says that where you arrive does not matter as much as what sort of person you are when you arrive there.
Mm.
So it's the same, I'm kind of saying the same thing two different ways, is that who you are becoming and how you make other people feel along your journey through life, I think is the most important things. If you get to the end of your life and you've accrued all of this financial success and you have all these things, but no one wants to spend time with you because you're a dick, I think that's a huge fail. So focus on who you are becoming and try and be as kind as you can, both to other people, but especially to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So very long way of saying, be kind to yourself, focus on the journey, not the destination, and think about who you are becoming instead of the external accomplishments.
Yeah, very good advice. Don't destroy your integrity for the external success and validation, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Gregory Russell Benedict, ladies and gentlemen, Gregory, one of my favorite episodes so far. You know, these are the best ones. Yeah, you deserve the celebration. It was really, really good. It's great when it's just like pickleball, back and forth conversation, catch each other's drift. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Dude, I appreciate you, Jacob. I'm so excited to watch your growth. You are absolutely crushing it at 21. I can't wait to see where you are at 31. You are curious, you are kind, and I am so grateful that you reached out and we made this happen. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Gregory. Really appreciate that. And where can people go if they actually want to find your work or be coached by you, etc.?
GregoryRussellBenedict.com. We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
The TEDx talk is called How Being Bold Will Change Your Life. Not How Being Bald Will Change Your Life. That is the top comment right now. It said, I thought this said bald and I was excited to watch. So How Being Bold Will Change Your Life. There's a link to my website there as well. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn a lot. And I look forward to chatting with you if this resonated.
Awesome. Dude, you're amazing. Looking forward to round two in the future.
Let's do it.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use to this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.